with oil in Iraq, pipeline in Afghanistan. Indians and Mexicans brought out the cavalry, 'cause they were in the way of manifest destiny. Guatemala had bananas, Somalia has oil, Venezuela has democracy that we wanna spoil. Cuba has cigars and rum, Filipino sugar cane. Colombia had the isthmus and some kilos of cocaine. But now our enemies are treasonous. They tell the truth and that's serious. It's adversity, it's mockery, it's insurgency, hostility. But mostly White House sociopathology. Daniel Ellsberg was once the most dangerous man for telling the truth about the war in Vietnam. And Bradley Manning's murder footage was too graphic of U.S. conduct clearly sociopathic. It's close to blowing, everybody should be knowing about corruption, the waste and abuse. Transparency is treasonous, democracy is dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. Edward Snowden told us all what we already knew, that the NSA is taking notes on everything we do. Is it worse that they are spying or covering up with lying with their files on where we go and with who? It's all so low and everybody should be knowing about corruption, waste and abuse. Transparency is treason and democracy is dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. Kiriakou fingered Brennan for torture in Guantanamo. Tom Drake, the NSA, for $1 billion a dough. Jeffrey Sterling, CIA, sabotaging nuclear blueprints to Iran, they were passing. It's close to blowing, everybody should be knowing about corruption, the waste and the abuse. Transparency is treasonous, democracy is dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. I was on the road in Buffalo on my way to Canada to go to a gig in Detroit. Seems they had me in a file as long as a quarter mile about the songs I sing and every joint. They took my passport with my truck in detention and submitted me to interrogation. I escaped captivity, now only outlaws will be free, living outside the law, get outside of this nation. It's cold, so blowing, everybody should be knowing about corruption, the ways and the views. Transparency is treasonous, civil liberties are dangerous. It's a crime to tell the truth. It's a crime to tell the truth.
Hi, that was Tom Nielsen from his CD, It's a Crime to Tell the Truth. And as I said last week, that song just, and so many of Tom's songs just resonate with us. And it's important to get the message out through music and other medias. We're going to be talking about corporate media. We're going to talk about repression. We're going to talk about how folks like us can reach people. And this is Lynn, my co-host this week.
Hi, I'm Lynn.
And later on, Lynn's going to be talking about student loan debt, student loan debtors, another class of debt slaves. We're also going to hear from brand new dad, Brian Powers, who is he's spearheading the $15 an hour now campaign here in New Jersey, and he'll talk to us about what's going on in New Jersey and across the United States, and hopefully he'll talk about the proposed Walmart strike.
Yeah, lots going on with Walmart, especially with Thanksgiving right around the corner. A lot's going on. We'll talk to Brian about that.
And And as I promised last week, we are going to bring singer-songwriter Tom Nielsen to talk about that terrific lead-in song, It's a Crime, as he has agreed to allow us to play that. We're going to play a couple more Nielsen songs and talk about them. And I think what I'll do right now, if I know how to work this button, is to bring Tom into the conversation. And Tom, are you with us?
Hey, I'm right here, Dave.
Hi, Tom. How are you? It's Lynn and Dave here.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I'm fine.
Well, good.
So how did the sound come through for It's a Crime?
It came through fine.
Great, great. Well, how did you come to write that song, Tom? What was the inspiration behind that?
I think it was the last person to do it, I think was when Chelsea Manning got picked up and sent to jail. I can't remember the whole chronology with Susan Landau and Colleen Rowley, and I know Kiriakou, I think, was before that. But it was, you know, these guys are Colleen and Sue and others are just a very small handful of people who have had their lives turned upside down because they told the truth. You know, you have. Excuse me.
What was the truth that Manning exposed the big video that he had out there?
I think what he was exposing was military operations. Was that not? I'm trying to remember. I know a lot of it got hushed up quite quickly, but I think he was showing, again, violations of the Constitution, human rights, abuses, and I believe that's what she was reporting revealing.
The collateral murder video that he
had. That's right. In
the
Iraq.
The murder of the journalist.
That's right. And when people went to help the people that had been shot, then they waited and they shot the people that were coming to rescue and help. That's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's,
it was
that's
the intentional shooting of civilians. That was the main thing. That's right.
Right. And they call that double tap.
Tom, I don't want to put you on the spot, and I don't want to tax your memory here, but I don't know whether our listeners are aware that you suffered quite an injury about a year ago. And how are you doing with that?
Well, I still can't play guitar. I had to cancel everything for this year. I haven't scheduled for next year. You know, it's a day at a time. My spine got whacked pretty hard, and I am getting treatment from a number of different providers. They're taking good care of me. And, you know, I'm better than I was a year ago. I'm better than I was 4 months ago. And I hope to recover from this.
Well, that's...
We wish you the best.
We wish
yeah.
you a very speedy recovery because
yeah.
the movement needs you and musicians who are willing to expose truths. But you are working on something right now, right? The People's Music Network, you're putting on a program?
Actually, we are having it in Greenfield. The PMN, People's Music, tours, well, it doesn't tour. It meets twice a year. And in the winter, the last weekend of January, it meets in some city in the Northeast, usually the Northeast. And we had it in Greenfield 5 years ago, and it's coming back to Greenfield this January. And this is the People's Music Network for Songs of Freedom and Struggle. And anyone who wants to participate in that can go to peoplesmusic.org. It's a weekend of professional musicians and amateurs and people who love to sing and write and people who don't do either, but just love being with this whole eclectic group of folks. We have a concert Friday night.
We can all stay at your house, right?
Yeah. I got lots of tents. We can put them out in the backyard.
There you go.
It's a weekend filled with workshops and song swaps. Everyone gets an opportunity to sing a lot. And people who are interested in the performing arts as a career, you're surrounded by a lot of people who do it full-time as a business, and you can get a lot of mentoring. Kim and Reggie Harris are the mentors for the weekend. They're the headliners. But we got a lot of good folks there.
Well, that sounds terrific, and I hope people take advantage of that. I hope you're not under 2 feet of snow out there.
And that's in January, right, of next year?
Last weekend of January, last full weekend, 23,
24, 25. Great, awesome.
Well, getting back to your the introductory song, and thank you so much for allowing us to use it. I read so much, and most of the things that you sing about, Tom, in your songs, and when you have your house concerts and you educate, handfuls of people, I'm not reading that on, in my local newspaper. I'm not reading that in the New York Times. I'm not reading that in the Wall Street Journal. How is it that you're able to find out these things?
Well, I left the country during the Vietnam War back in 1970. And leaving the country opened up the world to me in many ways. And one of the things that opened up was news about my own country. Now, I wasn't so naive in 1970 to think that my country was telling me the truth, because I knew they weren't. But I didn't know to the extent that our government, through the media, fabricates information. Wars happen because lies are told about them and the people who we want to be having a war with. War is profitable. We make money off of war. When I say we, I mean the U.S. government and the corporations that run it. And with Iraq and Iran, we supported both sides. The United States needs a market for all the weapons that we produce. The weapons manufacturers aren't going to make money unless there are wars. You can't tell the truth about what is going on, because the truth, in its most fundamental explanation, is people around the world are fighting in self-defense, protecting themselves from the U.S. government. They're protecting themselves in various ways. Again, first and foremost is just wanting to be able to control their resources, their land, and ability to feed themselves without some corporate agribusiness coming in, taking over their land, introducing high-yield seeds and then GMO seeds, which were not produced to feed people but were produced for export agriculture. Henry Kissinger's, one of his many notable quotes was, if you want to control a country, control the oil. But if you want to control the population, control the food. And that's what we do around the world. And people resist that. We have cell phone wars in the Congo. I mean, there are water. Something as fundamental as water around the world is becoming such a premium commodity. Is water in this country is threatened by gas and oil drilling, mountaintop removal, radioactive waste, agricultural poisons, and climate change. And the same things are affecting people all around the world. And how do they protect themselves? They resist in whatever way that they can. And what our government is like in terms, I mean, you were in October, you were down in the plaza as I was. I mean, you saw ultimately how the police came in and cleared people out, and the U.S. response to dissent is a very violent one. And
we're seeing that right now. We're seeing that the buildup right now outside of Ferguson in Missouri.
Yeah, the whole militarization of the police in this country, there's a very obvious reason for that, because there is getting more and more unrest in this country And what is the U.S. government to do? We have the highest per capita incarceration rate in the country. We have an indentured student population to the tune of $1 trillion. We have people whose voting rights are being taken away. We have the new Jim Crow that is busting black people wrist over fist in this country. And it's not, you don't see it and hear it in the news, but one of the wonderful things about the internet is that it does put us in touch globally with what is happening. And I do believe that the U.S. government is thinking that they are going to have their police force functioning in the capacity of the military to control this population, because why else do you give tanks and armored vehicles and hand grenades and the automatic weapons and stuff that police forces are getting, and they have to use them within a year or they lose them, is the stipulation, I understand. And so what is the reason for giving this equipment with the stipulation that you have to use it or lose it?
The old expression is, if all you have in your toolbox is a hammer,
mm-hmm.
everything looks like a nail.
Everything looks like a nail, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And well, and so with your original question, though, like how do I know a lot of the stuff that I write and sing about, it's because I've spent several years in Africa, in South America. I taught in Europe for a bit. I've traveled through Asia. I've lived, I don't know how many countries I've lived and worked in, but a number of them. And I have learned where to look for information about these places. I have my own experience about them that when I, like in Somalia, the only people I have heard say anything true about Somalia, in my opinion, since I left that place in 84, is, let's see, Jeremy Scahill. I can't think of this guy's name now. He was in Somalia, too, with the UN, doing the same type of work I was, and I'm blanking on his name. But it's when I was there, what I was doing was a total sham. It was I don't want to take up all your time talking about the work, but it does get into whistleblowing, because I was reprimanded by Geneva. I got a cable one day reprimanding me for not sending in this report. And I went to the UN superior saying I gave you the support report to send, and I was told it wasn't sent because I had told the truth. And if I wanted, this is not verbatim, but essentially the message was, if I wanted a career with the UN, that I was not going to tell the truth, because telling the truth was not consistent with U.S. foreign policy in the region. Now, that's not the first time that happened to me. It happened to me in another country as well.
So they held a paycheck over your head.
What?
They held a paycheck over your head.
Well, in my case, it wasn't the paycheck, because I didn't want a career with the U.N. I had seen enough. And actually, that was my last job, working with a government entity overseas, because I felt that no matter what good I might be doing, I was just a cog in the wheel of oppression, that the U.S. State Department needed people like me to provide some semblance of integrity or order so that they could achieve the greater picture, which in this case, you know, keep Siad Barre in power and keep, again, there was a hostility, you know, if you look at Eritrea and Ethiopia and Somalia, we don't have time to go into the whole metaphysics of why all those people are fighting each other and the U.S. government's role in it, but it was extremely manipulative. I was part of that, and I acknowledge that I was part of that system, and they needed... And they need good people in the system. I'm not saying that everyone who works in the whole international, what's called international development, or you can call it international dependency, or NGOs or UN people or State Department people are all on the dole and all out there to exploit people, because they're not. But the greater system is. And they need good people to do good work so that the greater goal can be achieved. And that goal, like in Somalia, was to keep the U.S.'s dictator in power.
So people might enter into the UN or might enter into NGOs, which are non-governmental organizations, with a good purpose, a purpose of serving humanity or good goals. But then once they get in there, they might find that there is this hand over them, this overseeing power that would deter or negate any sort of, I wouldn't want to say censor. And I can see that. I was listening to a woman who is on the Swedish anti-nuclear board talking yesterday about our 1,000-plus military bases that we have around the world. And she said that the U.S. had recently contracted with, I believe it was Brazil. They're very, very worried about South America, especially in the areas of Venezuela and other countries that are becoming more equality, because they don't want that to break out anywhere anytime soon. So they had contracted with this country, I believe it was Brazil, to build 6 U.S. military bases.
And I'm going to play another Tom Nielsen song that incorporates this theme, and we'll pick up our conversation when that's over. So here we go with After the Week.
There was a meltdown that happened somewhere. Poison the earth, water and air, but it isn't news with the TV or press, 'cause that was the week of Lady Gaga's new dress. Antiquities being destroyed in Iraq, children are starving from U.S. attack, but we never gave it 1 minute thought, 'cause that was the week John Edwards got caught. Telecom industry caught up in spying. Bush and Obama caught up in lying. State Department war is inciting. But that was the week survivors were fighting. Bradley Manning is sitting in jail. Patriot Act is reading your mail. Aaron Schwartz is suicidal, but everyone's watching American Idol. That was the week more families died. Drones in the skies commit genocide. Oh, that was the week they could have been saved, but there wasn't room for them on the front page. Oh, that was the week. That was the week. Fukushima radiation is reaching our shore. Afghanistan's looking like El Salvador. Plutonium is leaking in Paducah, Kentucky. While you scratch a card to see if you're lucky. Wars in the Congo to make our cell phones. Mercury in your teeth, fluoride in your bones. Glyphosate say that our food causes cancers, but that was the week. The stars and their dancers, Monsanto is changing the food that we eat. Genetically altering seeds with deceit. Roundup is coming out in your urine. My brothers in prison are torturing urine. Jill Stein and Sherry are shackled to chairs. Media is acting like they're unaware. While Obama and Romney from Wall Street debating, doing each other incestuous mating. But we didn't care, 'cause we didn't know. We only saw what they chose to show. We got our kicks, we're not complaining. It's only news if it's entertaining. Oh, that was the week. $100 a week. Shell kills the ozone, there's blood in its oil. Texaco's burning a forest to spoil. Bovine growth hormone is milk in the public, but that was the week. Kardashians were Luxico, that was the week of corporate crime. Whitewash of justice, time after time, oh, that was the week voting rights were suspended. That was the year civil liberties ended, oh, that was the week, that was the year, those were the stories we didn't hear. That was the week, that was the week, that was the week.
That was such a powerful song, Tom. Thank you so much for writing that and allowing us to play it. That's also from your album, It's a Crime to Tell the Truth. Tom, where can we find your music? Where can we buy your CDs?
Well, you can drop a dime to me, and I'll get it out to you. You can buy it online, or you can book me when I can play guitar again, and you can buy it at the show.
So you have a Facebook page. It's
I have
Tom
a Facebook
Nielsen.
Page. My website is tomnielsenmusic.com. And anyone who wants to buy something, just send me an email, and we can do it through the mail.
That would be great. I hope people do book you. We've had you here in New Jersey for a couple of house concerts, and I'll tell you, it's a remarkable experience. It's educational. It's fun. And we get a chance to bring out the good paper plates.
Hey, the food's great at your place, too.
People
should come to your venue just to eat and drink, man, I tell you. Forget the
and
music.
And yet, Dave does all of the cooking.
Well, someone has to.
But, you know, I played that song at one place. I did it in Miami once, and after the show, two journalists with the Miami Herald came up to me and thanked me for it. They were very clear. They just said, you know, thank you for singing that stuff, because they said, we know what line not to cross. We know what to write, what not to write. And I've had other journalists say the same thing. And, you know, when we were attacked by Contras on a couple occasions back in 1980, see, I was down in 85 and 86 in Nicaragua, and when I came back to the States, I went to the local paper, and the political editor for the paper told me that the attack didn't happen. I said, what do you mean? She said, if it had happened, it would have been on the AP line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the U.S. doesn't put it out, and then newspapers don't pick it up, and they just say it didn't happen. And so that's one example of how information is controlled in this country. Otherwise, if you look at the news, look at what's on passes for television shows, it's not particularly stimulating, it's not particularly educational, it's not particularly multicultural or going to teach you something about the world.
Well, that's certainly corporate media.
We call it corporate controlled media.
We're fawning corporate media. That's why we really have to look at independent media, including a great television program by, let's say, Acronym TV.
Dennis Traynor Jr., my man.
Dennis Traynor and so many great websites out there for information.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing, I mean, we're talking about the media, and I think this is important. If it digresses too much, just let me know. But we have another presidential election coming up in a couple years, and it's no revelation that the media focuses on one of two Wall Street candidates. One of the reasons for that is an organization called the Commission on Presidential Debates, was created in 1987 by Republicans and Democrats essentially to guarantee that only Democrats and GOP would be at the podiums. And that's it. That's why they refuse to debate Green Party, Libertarian, Socialist, Justice Party, whatever the other party is, they refuse to debate them. The media doesn't cover them. They don't exist.
So what happened, Tom, when the Green Party tried to get in the 2012 debate?
Well, in the one case in Hofstra and Hempstead, Long Island, Dr. Jill Stein and Sherry Honkler, her vice presidential candidate, were walking to the debate, and they were stopped by the police, and they were arrested. They were handcuffed to chairs in a warehouse in Hempstead for 8 hours, surrounded by, I forget how many officers, Jill said, maybe 13 or 14 officers, until the debate was long over. And they're not the only ones. David Cobb was arrested trying to be a presidential candidate.
Right.
I'm trying to think who the Bednarik, Michael Bednarik, the Libertarian candidate, once was arrested trying to be a candidate. And Ralph Nader in Hartford, Connecticut, at that debate was removed. And so, and the media goes along with this completely. You know, or if you look at how it's reported, here in Massachusetts, we just had an election. There were five candidates running for governor. But if you look at the vote tally in the local paper, 100% of the people voted for either the Republican or the Democrat, but in Franklin County. But the reality was over 11% voted for someone else, and those votes were disappeared. 13.5% here in Greenfield voted for someone other than the Republican and the Democrat, and their votes were lost in 100% for the Wall Street Party.
That's by design, Tom. That wants to crush any idea that voting for someone other than a corporate-owned party has any meaning whatsoever.
Exactly. And I would not be surprised if we saw that, you know, duplicated in other newspapers around the state, around the country. And that's why it's made so hard for a non-Wall Street candidate, unless you can buy your way in like Ross Perot did back in 92. And he got, if you remember, he got 19% of the vote. And that's pretty scary, although he was a Wall Street guy himself. He was more of a maverick. But he got 19%. And that's quite a large number. And since then, they have the Dems and GOP have been able to keep any opposition off the stage.
And that's because people believe that there is a difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. I'm talking about a majority qualitative difference between them. There are small differences, but overall, there's not a large difference between them. They're both owned by Wall Street. They're both going to totally toe the line with whatever Wall Street or the money interest wants them to do. But people believe, and I guess it's from they're just being involved in the day-to-day media that there is a difference between the two.
But we know that they're ideologically in lockstep.
In lockstep.
Well,
in 2012, they would come out with these differences, but they didn't talk about the war. They didn't talk about mass incarceration. They didn't talk about single-payer health care. They didn't talk about anything important. They just nitpicked on the edges of little things.
Let's take a look. You know, what do they have in common? NAFTA? NDAA, Patriot Act, military commissions, Gitmo, drones, loss of civil liberties, profiteering from health care and energy, depleted uranium, mountaintop removal, fracking, $1 trillion perpetual wars, militarized police, largest incarceration rate in the world. Both of those parties give us this. GMOs, Monsanto's making food policy. Do Republicans object to that? Of course not. $18 trillion bailouts, that... Everyone was in agreement with that. 100 senators voted for a massacre in Palestine. $1 trillion student debt. Obama had the option of, you know, he can come up with $18 trillion to bail out the banks. Another trillion to bail out the students would actually, it would have been great for the economy.
Yep.
But no.
You know, on that note, Mr. Nielsen.
Yes, sir.
I am going to play.
I didn't even get to tar sands in the TPP. And sleeping in constitutional surveillance. You know, I mean, who would not want to spoil that? Who would not want, because third parties are always called spoilers. I mean.
Tom, would you come back another time?
I would be delighted.
We would love to have you.
We would love to have you.
We've got a lot of songs. We need to talk about more of them.
And I'm just going to say this before I play your 4 years of college, which you collaborated on. One of the most powerful songs that I've ever heard you do, and they're all powerful. They're all extremely powerful and thought-provoking and educational. But I got to tell you, when I heard you play These Colors Don't Run, it's spine tingling. When you played that at Freedom Plaza, during the occupation of Freedom Plaza, you played, that is just such a fantastic song, and that's why it is imperative that you hurry back.
Yeah, come back so we can play that song.
And you know, get your hand in good shape there and you know, get back in the saddle, my friend.
All right, well, listen, I appreciate all the work you two do. Keep the music alive.
I'm going to play this song, and then we are going to say thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to pick up on student loan debt servitude, and we will have you back. We'll have you back very soon, Tom.
All right. Well, thank you much.
Take care,
bye-bye,
Tom.
Now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, some people say you gotta get a degree, but after 4 years you gotta pay back the fee. Well, I'm paying my dues. I'm out on my own. Oh, how am I gonna pay back the student loan I borrowed for school so I could get smart, to bio and chem, music and art, and took a full load of English and history. And now I got a job serving coffee and tea, going to 4 years of college. What do you get? A crappy job at a mountain of death, St. Peter. Don't you call me, cause I got to stay. Oh, my soul, Sally Mae. Now Obama bailed out all of the banks, 12 trillion from the Fed to buy more tanks. He could have paid my loans so I could make a rent. Yeah, sure, he is. President, they alter the terms unilaterally. I'm the promissory note they took from me. Every time I pay, they always delay to maximize the interest that comes their way. You go to 4 years of college, what do you get? A crappy job and a mountain of debt, St. Peter. Don't you call me, cause I got to stay. Oh, my soul, Sally Mae. You're disabled or dead and gone. Your predatory lending loan lives on. They can garnish your social security, and you can discharge bankruptcy. My dreams have suffered a crushing defeat, so I hitched a ride down to occupy Wall Street. People were saying all over town, oh, none of us pays. We can take the banks down. You go to 4 years of college. What do you get? Crappy job and a mountain of debt. Saint Peter, don't you call me, cause I got to stay. I owe my soul to Sally Mae.
Awesome. Wonderful. Tom Nielsen, thank you so much for joining us, and we definitely want to have you back. You have so many wonderful, wonderful songs. If you tuned into us last week, I had mentioned that my experience, my personal experience, my family's experience, my peers' experience, my tax clients' experience, my neighbors, my community, everybody that I talk to about student loan debt, my experience is that college is no longer about higher education. It is about feeding the coffers of the vultures of the financial district. And that is done in many, many, many ways, and it is done slowly, like the boiling frog premise. Boiling frog is you put a frog in water and then you start to boil it, and it doesn't really start to get uncomfortable until the water really starts to get hot. Well, we're at that boiling point right now. The water is hot. And my experience has been that college is now set up to feed financial industry. Wall Street loves it. The administrators at colleges and universities across the nation, they love it because they are making millions of dollars in salaries and bonuses and special deferred compensation plans and apartments and housing and chauffeur-driven limousines, much like the hospitals are, and they are pushing students, unsuspecting students, teenagers, into a lifetime of debt. And then once they get into this debt, there's a whole new financial market that opens up that services the loan, that guarantees the loan, that collects the loan. It's just really insidious. And as I often say, anybody who's read my my emails, it's designed by psychopaths. Anyway, so there's a lot to go on. There's a lot to talk about in the student loan debt market. And tonight I want to talk a little bit about the repayment options for those who already have the debt, who have signed on the bottom line at financial aid offices, and they've gone to college, they've maybe gone to graduate school, maybe gone to law school, maybe gone to medical school, and now they're stuck with this debt. So I want to talk a little bit tonight about the repayment options. You're not going to find any of this in any of the corporate-controlled media. The New York Times does a very good job of masquerading or camouflaging the underlying issue, the issues, by saying, oh, you know, you have to save, or you have to, you know, set up a plan, or you have to
move in with your parents,
or move in with your parents, or cut the cable bill, or you don't really need that many data on your iPhone, do you? You know. So anyway, here's a little bit about some of the repayment options for student loan borrowers / debtors that are listening. Now, the first two I'm going to talk about are allow you to temporarily postpone payments without going into default. Default is the big D word. You don't want to do that. You don't want to go into default. And I will cover default on a separate show. But right now I'm just going to talk about the repayment. So the first one that is out there is forbearance. Now, forbearance is a program that kicks the can down the road. What that means is that you are allowed by your student loan servicer, and last week I touched a little bit on the fact that if you have federal student loan debt, just we're talking federal now, just to break down student loan debt, it's 1.2 of the, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it is $1.2 trillion. About $1 trillion of that is federal student loan debt, and the balance is what's called private student loan debt, and there is a qualitative and quantitative difference between federal and private student loan debt, which I touched on a little bit last week and we'll talk about in a future show. But in general, forbearance on federal loans, some private loans may have this available. What it allows you to do is to take several months off from paying your student loan nut, but all that does is make the matter worse because let's say your student loan debt, just as an example, is $28,000 at 6%. Roughly, it's about $6 a day interest. daily interest is very important for student loan borrowing. Know your daily interest cost. So it's $6. So if you've got a six-month forbearance, which allows you in writing to not pay your loans for 6 months and not have that go into default, all that does is add about $1,100 to your loan. So now that $1,100 in interest that you didn't pay over 6 months is added to the principal, so now you owe more than $28,000. Okay, you owe $29,100, so now your daily interest is even worse. So forbearance kicks the can down the road. The second repayment program is called a deferment, and the deferment program is something that's normally offered to students who might have graduated and said, gee, I don't know, the job market doesn't look good. I think I'm going to go back and get my master's, and that would allow a deferment, and in most popular in-school deferment. It's the same as above. It just kicks the can down the road. The interest is still accruing. It's still being capitalized, meaning it's being added to the total balance that you owe. So when you hear the media say you have these two options, all it's doing is getting you further into debt. Now, there are some forgiveness programs for students out there, for debtors out there. The first one that they talk about quite often is the Teacher Loan Forgiveness Program. And again, I'm only talking about federal loans. A federal loan is any loan recognized by the Federal Reserve as issued by the federal government. So if you have a state-issued loan, it's not a federal loan. If you have a loan from a bank, it's not a federal loan. It's a private loan, and each loan is a personal promise to pay. You sign a promissory note to repay that loan, and you would have to visit the specifics of that loan to see what your options are on the private level. On the federal level, we have the Teacher Loan Forgiveness. So the Teacher Loan Forgiveness Program is broken into two separate segments. The first is for direct loan. Direct loan is the most common loan. I would say probably 100% of the young debtors that I've talked to in the last, those that have graduated college in the last 10 years, have direct loans. These are the loans that you're given. They're very small amounts given each year. And those, so most people have a direct loan. Now, the Teacher Forgiveness Program, the direct loan for has an option where if you work for a qualified low-income school for 5 years consecutively, you can be eligible for up to $17,500 worth of forgiveness. Now, when I talk about forgiveness, I'm talking about tax-free forgiveness. Forgiveness has two possibilities. It goes into two chutes. It's either taxable or it's not taxable. This is a tax option. However, there's always caveat. However, in order to get the $17,500 worth of forgiveness, working 5 years as a qualified teacher in a qualified low-income school, and that the low-income school is based on the number of free lunches that the school gives out, and there is a website that you can go to and look to see whether your school qualifies, and we'll put that all up on our website where you can go.
What is our website? LodgeInTheBalanceSheet.org.
There you go. However, the $17,500 worth of forgiveness, let me back up a second here. I'm going to back up a second. Last week, if you were listening, if you tuned in, I talked about the direct loan program. The direct loan program for this coming year, the maximum amount for 4 years of college that you can borrow is $27,000. The total forgiveness under this program is $17,500, but you have to have been either a math, science, or special ed teacher and you have to have worked for 5 years in a qualifying low-income school, a school that serves low-income students. So the qualifications are enormous, and you have to pay very close attention to them. In addition, if you work in a school, let's say you're a science teacher, you graduated from college, you're a science or math or special ed teacher, and you go to a school, and you transfer to another school, or you go to another school, you have to get a sign-off of the application from each school by the superintendent or principal of that school. So there is a large amount of paperwork involved. However, if you are a math, science, or special ed teacher and you teach in a district that is considered to be qualified, you can get a, after 5 years, and you have to continue to make during the 5 years your direct loan payment. Every payment has to be on time and not past due. You are qualified to make application at the end of the fifth year to have the balance of your loans forgiven.
And you have to make application.
You have to make application, and you have to make application with each school that you're in. So if you work in the same school, it would not be as much of an issue as opposed to...
What if the school says no?
Well, that's a whole other process. You could go the 5 years. Let's say you go the whole 5 years at the same school. You fill out the application. You get the superintendent or principal to sign off. It goes to your loan servicer, and there are 11 authorized student loan servicers by the federal government. Sallie Mae is the largest. There's many others out there, FedLoan, Great Lakes, a lot of others. You send the application to your servicer, and they have 60 days. You have to keep making the payments through all this time. They have 60 days to send it to the guarantor of the loan, who is the one who will actually fund the forgiveness. So it's not like your loan disappears, poof. It's who is going to pay off that loan, and that is a whole other battle.
So it's not automatic.
Oh, no. Oh, no, it's not automatic. I don't know what the percentage acceptance rate is, but from what I've read, it's questionable. So 17.5 if you are a math, science, or special ed teacher. For all other teachers who teach in a qualified school district that has the right amount of free student loan lunches and you work there and you're in qualified teaching, you still have to make application after 5 years. You still have to make payment on your direct loans during that time. You have to make payment during the 60-day process when they send it to the guarantor. The maximum amount that will be forgiven is $5,000 for everyone else. So if you teach gym, English, arts, anything outside of science, math, or special ed, they reduce the amount that they will forgive from $17,500 to $5,000. There is also another program. It's called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And, again, this is a program for direct and Stafford loans. These are federal loans that are given out when you first attend college. And the qualifications for this program are that you must be employed in certain public service jobs, federal, state, local, a government agency, or a qualified nonprofit, what we accountants call a 501c3, an IRS-recognized 501c3 entity. However, if you work for a public library, if you work for the DA, if you work for other entities that get taxpayer funding, you may qualify also for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. And this program is only available, I should mention the other one also, the Teacher Loan Forgiveness Program, is only available for for debtors and teachers for loans after October 2007. For the Public Service Loan Forgiveness, You must complete the certification form annually and submit it to your servicer. You have to prove to your servicer, I don't know why you would have to prove to your servicer because you're paying them and they have the records, but you have to prove to your servicer that you've made a year's worth of on-time payments on your loan. And I have to say that the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program is a program that forgives the balance of your loans after you make 120 monthly on-time payments. And I will add the caveat that most direct loans only have a 10-year term. So it kind of seems self-defeating. However, what this program is really targeting is not the four-year graduate, but the graduate student, the law school, the medical school, the other students who went on after 4 years of college and got additional loans. Those loans would also be available, and the way they would qualify is if you go into one of the government's four income contingent repayment plans, which is based on your income. It's capped at about 10% of your income, so your payment is lowered, and after 10 years, you would be eligible for total loan forgiveness tax-free. So,
is that guaranteed?
It's not enough. Is anything guaranteed with the government?
Taxes.
Yeah. It is something that is the VA in particular is using to entice doctors and nurses to come and work for them, especially since their scandal where they've had patients waiting so long that they died, and they are on an aggressive program to recruit doctors and nurses. Doctors, of course, are usually come out with about $250,000, $300,000 worth of student loan debt, much of it federal, much of it direct loans. And they are enticing them, saying, you know, you could have about $100,000 worth of your loan forgiven. And that is true right now, today, as we speak. And it's a pretty good deal. I would think that's a pretty good deal. But you have to work there for 10 years, make annual application, and you can have it forgiven tax-free. Now, I will mention on the other programs that I mentioned, the income contingent programs, there are four. Why there are four, I don't know. It's just the way the government likes to confuse everybody. Those programs, say you have federal loans and you can't make the payments, you can apply to a program that would require you once a year to submit your tax return, and they would say, okay, you make $30,000 a year, 10% of that, this is what you have to pay. Of course, the interest keeps accruing. The nice part about it under this program is it doesn't matter what the interest is accruing on it. If you work 10 years and you qualify and it's still in place in 10 years, your loans, the total balance of your loans is forgiven tax-free. Tax-free is a big thing because under the income contingent program, not under the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, if you have to pay for 20 years and your loans at the end of 20 years, no matter what the balance is, which in most cases it's probably going to be equal to what you went into or more, depending upon what your income is, it's taxable. So they're forgiving tax. So if they're forgiving a loan of $100,000 less, that's taxable. So
meaning they treat the forgiven debt as income.
Yes.
And you have to pay whatever your income tax rate would be.
That's correct, unless you fall under certain exclusions from the income tax law. Perhaps there is an insolvency clause that is under debate whether or not they would qualify under that. There's a lot of debate about whether or not that qualifies. I get different perspectives on that. So those are the two types of forgiveness options. The other thing.
I think the conversation, instead of being repayment options. Shouldn't we just be abolishing student loan debt?
Of course. Oh, what are we building? Fixed military bases down in Brazil? I mean, why can't we, you know, why are we expanding?
I read an article the other day where the U.S. government is profiting by $50 million each year on interest payments made by students.
That's true.
And I'm also told that it would be less expensive for the government to simply write a check to the college, pay for the education. They spend more to originate, insure, service, and collect on these student loans than if they were simply to pay the cost to the colleges directly. No loans. That's a discussion we should be having.
Absolutely. We should be having that discussion, but people aren't really thinking about that for the most part. They're more concerned with how am I going to pay back my debt, and it's a very tough situation to be in when you're faced with that amount of debt. You talked about the government's profitability on the loan. When Obama came into office in January of 2009, one of the first things he did was eliminate the Federal Family Education Loan Program. It's called FFELP. And the FFELP program, basically what it did was the federal government said to a student, okay, you can have a $5,000 loan. We're going to go over to this. I'm going to use Sallie Mae because they were the largest consumers of FFELP. Okay, we authorize you to take your money, give $5,000 to that school. We'll guarantee it, and we'll pay you a fee to do that. Well, for Sallie Mae, if you read their quarterly SEC statements, they loved the FFELP program because they were making money hand over fist. It's what we call in the accounting industry a cash cow. And when Obama came in, he basically said, well, you know what? Why do we have to give all that money to Sallie Mae? We could just have it here. We could just have it right in our own, you know, education budget, have all that money. So he discontinued it. So after that, starting July 2009, federal loans were dispersed directly from the federal government, cutting out the middleman, which was the servicers.
But they didn't eliminate the fees or the interest.
No, they didn't.
They could have.
They could have, of course. But my point is that Sallie Mae realized a couple of years ago that their FFELP loans were diminishing, and that was their cash cow. So what did Sallie Mae do? They said, well, we're going to create a new entity. We're going to call it Navient. We're going to call it Navient. That sounds nice. It's just one word. It's not two words. It's one word. And it sounds nicer. It's kind of calm and, you know, serene. And what we're going to do is we're going to take all our Sallie Mae loans, and we're going to transfer them over to Navient. And Navient is now going to service all our student loan debt. So what's Sallie Mae going to do? Well, Sallie Mae thought, how are we going to get back all the money that we made under the FFELP program? I know what we'll do. Sallie Mae will now reorganize, and we will be dedicated to going to college campuses, going to high schools, going anywhere we can, and we're going to introduce kids into predatory student loan debt, private loan debt, credit card debt, payday loans, whatever we can get them signed up for. And you've got now teenagers who have passed teenage years being besieged even more so than in the past with signing up for predatory debt that they will not be able to pay. Well, you might think, well, that's not a very smart business move on Sallie Mae's part. I mean, doesn't in the long term, it doesn't sound very good, does it? But who's going to bail out these students?
Mom and dad.
Grandma, grandpa. That's right. They know that they're going to come home and they're going to say, oh, geez, I signed up for this, I signed up for that, and the parents are going to bail them out. So in the short term, it's pretty good. But in the long term, it's not.
You know, in a couple of minutes, we're going to be speaking with Brian Powers, who is spearheading the 15 Now movement in New Jersey and in the United States, trying to get people a living wage so that if they do have student loan debt, they can make an honest attempt to to repay it. But we'll get to Brian in a couple of minutes. I know he's very excited because he has a new baby in the house.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool. I'm surprised he's even able to stay up past 9 o'clock. So why don't you wrap up what you're talking about and tell us what you're going to talk about on the next program.
Okay, well, I wanted to talk one more thing. How much time do I have, Dave?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, so I want to talk about one more aspect of the loan program.
4 minutes.
One of the areas that is enticing, which I started out with for forbearance and deferment, is that you will not go into default. I'm going to stress right now, the last thing anybody who has student loan debt wants to do is to go into default. Whether it's federal or private, you do not want to go into default. On a private level, if you go into default, it's only between 120 and 180 days. On a federal level, if you do not make a payment for 270 days, which is 9 months, you are considered in default. And that is a very serious condition. And I'm giving you the signal that I only have 2 minutes left to talk, which is not enough to talk about rehabilitation and default. So we're going to carry that over to the next program. But heed my words, if you want to talk to me about your student loans, you can email us, you can contact us at our website, at our Facebook page, and I will be happy to help you through the myriad of programs they set up to confuse borrowers about student loan debt.
I did want to talk about our next program, which will be December 5. December 5th, and we'll be talking about those mysterious lines and streaks we see in the sky. They're called chemtrails. And we're going to have singer-songwriter Jeff Satson, who produced the award-winning video and song by the same name, Murdering Us from the Sky. Jeff is free to come on, and we're going to talk about that. And then on December 12th, our guests will be Professor Louie and People for a New Society, and we're going to discuss Louie's terrific song, What It Means to Be Working Class, from his new CD, Class. And with that, we are going to invite Brian Powers, the chairperson of 15 Now New Jersey. And Brian, are you with us?
Yes, Dave, Lynn, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hi, Brian. Congratulations
on your new baby.
Yeah, it's been quite an exciting day, and this is a great way to wrap it up with you guys tonight.
What is his name?
His name is Brian David Jr. He's my fifth son. He came around about 10:39 this morning, and he weighs 7 pounds and 10 ounces.
Congratulations.
Well, we have another worker in the world.
Well, hopefully child labor laws haven't gotten that lax, and he has a couple of years to be a baby, but who knows?
Well, we're counting on you to help us down that road. So tell us something about 15 Now. What is it? I've seen cars, I've seen shirts, I've seen demonstrations in front of municipal and state and federal offices. What's going on?
Well, I mean, it's a really exciting time, I think, for the living wage movement. We saw in the last election cycle a lot of people crying about the Republicans taking over the Senate. But the second story, at least the story for those of us, you know, in the living wage movement, was all the living wage legislation that passed. You know, in the past, we had Seattle pass the $15 an hour minimum wage, which Chalmers Sawant's campaign. Over this last election cycle, we saw victories in Minneapolis. We saw San Francisco raise the wage to $15 an hour. We saw four states, Alaska, Nebraska, Arkansas, and South Dakota, all pass increases in the minimum wage. And we've also passed referendums in Boston. We have efforts going on in Chicago, Philly, Portland, Maine, New York City, and right here in New Jersey. So, you know, there's a lot of activism going on at a grassroots level. And people have even taken notice and taken it to a state level already. And you know, we started in New Jersey about 4 or 5 months ago with just a Facebook page. We've grown to a group of about 40 activists. And we're just beginning a campaign, hopefully, that will increase the minimum wage in the state of New Jersey to $15 an hour.
I think this year 15, next year 20.
Well, you know, there is some argument that it should even be higher. If you look at the MIT Living Wage Calculator, which is a great resource, you just Google MIT Living Wage Calculator, it gives you an idea of what the living wage is for every specific region of the country. You can even break it down to your specific city. And there's cities in New Jersey, and we all know New Jersey has one of the highest cost of living, if not the highest cost of living in the country, depending on what study you're looking at. I mean, there's arguments that are made through several studies that the living wage in New Jersey is $20 or $21 an hour. So I think to say that $15 an hour is a minimum wage is a very legitimate demand, and we don't plan on backing off of it.
Well, I think if you look at $15 now and look at the minimum wage we had back in the 70s, if the minimum wage kept pace with cost of living increases, it would now be over $20 an hour.
Yep. Yep. I've heard a lot of quotes like that. It does depend on, you know, what year you start your study at, where it should be. But, yeah, by all indications, anywhere in the 70s to present day, it should be over $20 an hour at least.
Yeah, and it sounds like if people got $15 an hour, they would have more purchasing power.
I mean, we get complicated, I think, sometimes in this country. Economists like to ponder on and on and on about a subject and do all kinds of studies, but everybody I know is broke. I'm broke myself, and the working class.
But we'll have to check out the mail to you tomorrow.
It's okay, no problem. But, the point is, you just look around and talk to your neighbors, your friends, your family. When you drop your kids off at school, everybody has been fired, laid off, taken a pay cut, paid more for their health insurance. It's not that complicated to think that working people just need more power in our economy by having more money to spend. And, you know, 15 now is not the only solution for fixing, you know, all the problems of our economy, but it's a huge step forward, not just in economic terms, but also in terms of power. Money is power in a capitalist system. So when you empower the working class, you empower by giving them more money. And, it's an honorable fight to be a part of. There's so many of us across the country fighting real hard, and you just feel like you're doing the right thing when you're fighting for a living wage, and that's the way I feel, and I know that's the way the rest of my organization does.
But, we look at corporate-owned newspapers, and we're always reading studies about how the economy is improving and how unemployment is dropping and how jobs are being created, and if you're left behind, it's your own damn fault. Well, that's not true. I mean, there are people who have simply given up looking for work, and it all goes back to when, in our economy, we left the farms and we headed to the cities because there were factory owners willing to pay us wages, which we really couldn't see on the farm anymore. So the problems we're having today have really evolved over time.
But they're affecting more and more people, so more and more people are able to connect the dots despite the corporate media's stranglehold on information. You might be watching a program that says, I heard that the stock market was up 91 points. Well, what does that mean to you, Brian?
that would only mean something if you're in the top 1% of people that own 85% of the stocks in this country.
And yet that's a major news story. Every day we have to hear about the stock market.
So what's going on with Walmart? I hear that there's a strike that's proposed for Black Friday.
I think around the country we're seeing a whole lot of things happening at Walmart, and I know that 15 Now is encouraging people in the North Jersey area to come out to the Walmart in North Bergen at 8:30 a.m. You can go ahead, check out our website. That's www.15nownj.org. We have a page on there dedicated to...
Wait, Brian, say that again, and say it slow so we can write it down.
Okay. It's www.15nownj.org, 15nownj.org, and on there we have a page where you can see our Walmart rally flyer. You can print it out, you can share it on social media, and we're going to be joining with protests around the country of Walmart. It's the largest employer in the country. Walmart employs over 1.3 million Americans. It's a larger employer than the federal government itself. The nine major shareholders are the Walton family. They have more wealth than the bottom 142 million people that live in this country. So we have nine people that have more money than 142 million people, and they've done it by paying slave wages, by not giving people an opportunity to get ahead. And I think they're just a centerpiece for a living wage campaign, because when you look at the history of wages being dragged down in this country over the last 30 or 40 years, certainly Walmart is probably the largest player in setting that trend. So I think it's only fair that as the working class unites behind a living wage, that we target one of the culprits in taking it away from us in the first place.
And we're talking about heirs. Heirs. It's not
mm-hmm.
like, you know,
yeah, Sam Walton passed away a number of years ago. These are children of money. I mean, they worked
yeah.
real hard to get there is what they're going to tell you, but I don't
yeah.
know. I worked hard for 14 years on telephone poles. I'm not really sure they know what that is.
Yeah. Somebody, I mentioned that to somebody, and they said it was the Lucky Sperm Club.
It's exactly what was in my mind, Lynn, but I guess I'll let you say it.
Let's not forget that Hillary Clinton was a corporate attorney for Walmart.
She served on the board of directors for Walmart.
Did serve
yeah.
on the board of
yes.
directors, and I'm sure she was very instrumental in many of the labor laws that are now coming back to haunt us.
You know, Hillary Clinton has a good way of turning towards the popular opinions on things. She did work for Walmart as and was on the board of directors for a number of years, while Walmart was openly engaged in union busting activity. I mean, part of Walmart's reason why they have been able to keep low wages perpetuated is the fact that they've been able to keep out union labor. And certainly Hillary was around while they were engaged in union busting practices. And then when she ran for the Senate, she did catch some heat for taking a contribution from Walmart, and she returned it. But she has a way of just doing what's popular in public. But I wouldn't think that Hillary Clinton's going to be a friend of the living wage movement. But we'll see.
You know, there's been union busting going on for 100 years. Unions
yeah,
held,
I know.
Such power, held such power, and they really held the 1% in a stranglehold by the balls going back. And it was instrumental. Unions and socialists and communists and third parties of all stripes, they were really instrumental in gaining the Great Concession, which was known as the New Deal. And that's
absolutely.
What it was.
And I think what you saw in Los Angeles, when you saw the Walmart workers striking, taping their mouths shut, chaining themselves into the stores, actually sit-down
yeah.
strikes, I mean, that right. If you know history, the first thing that pops into any labor historian's mind is the 30s and Detroit. You know, and really, I pinpoint that as the start of building a middle class in this country. That's the historical point in my mind where people said, wait a second, if I work hard all day, I should have a decent life and a decent living. And they were willing to sit down in factories and take over the means of production, literally. In order to get it. And, you know, I'm inspired by seeing what's gone on in Walmart around the country because, you know, despite the fact that we have been beaten down as a working class for so long, there's hope. There's people fighting. There's people fighting back, and they're fighting back hard. And I know that 15 now across the country and 15 now in New Jersey is rooting hard for these guys to make a difference.
What happened to the workers in Los Angeles?
Yeah, they did some sit-down strikes out there. They had some people go out and block some traffic. There were some arrests. It was all peaceful protesting and stuff like that, but they did have some sit-down strikes out in Walmart in Los Angeles.
Did we have the police coming in their big gear?
Their power
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
In their paramilitary gear, did they come in?
I didn't see anything like that in the pictures. The shots I saw, I only saw picture media. I didn't really view any video on it, but I did not see anything of that nature. I did see some arrests, you know, people getting picked up and put into handcuffs and things like that. But I didn't see any tear gas or anything like that.
Have you been arrested, Brian?
No.
There's still time. There's still time.
I guess. I was arrested years back in the Navy, but that had nothing to do with activism.
Yeah, we don't want to hear Navy stories.
No, it wasn't something honorable and for a cause. So let's put it, you know, it was a mistake of youth. I was just I spent the night making new friends.
Oh, that could go in so many different directions. I'm going to tell you though,
It was a minor incident. I never had any charges.
There was a minor involved?
No.
No, it was a minor incident. Minor incident. Hey, come on, you're killing me over there, man.
I'm going to say go back to your new baby, and I'm going to say I hope that you you can come back and give us further updates on 15 now and strikes that are bubbling up around the nation. And
cool.
Thank you so much for joining us.
I will, and I hope to see you all out at Walmart at 8:30 on Black Friday. Thanks a lot for the chance, guys. I'll talk to you real soon.
Thank you, Brian.
Good night, Brian.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you so much. Brian is among, I'm going to say, a growing handful of young adults throughout New Jersey that are really spearheading actions. They're getting involved with local politics. They're getting involved in organizing for many, many single issues. They're out there fighting for in a broad brush, economic democracy. They're fighting for civil rights. They're committing civil disobedience. And it's good. That's what we need. We need people to stand up. The more people that stand up, the easier it is for others who have a hard time standing up.
But we need people to be connected. We need to understand that we are all connected. We are not alone in our struggles. And a lot of people tend to internalize their struggles. And if you talk to your neighbors, as Brian had said, when he drops his kids off, he talks to his neighbors and his community, and he finds out what's really going on outside of what we're being indoctrinated to believe.
That's keep going.
It's very, very, very important to talk to your peers, your family, your community about what's going on, because I'll bet it's going on in their house also. I found that among my tax clients with student loan debt. Student loan debt is probably the largest area this past tax season that probably majority of my clients were very, very, very concerned. Also, health care costs. They were very concerned how they're going to pay for health care costs. That's a connection. That's a huge connection. Two types of debt that are out of control that we really need to talk about. It's not talked about. We really need to talk about it, get connected, and organize and do something about stopping them.
Well, the old expression is there are two ways to enslave a nation, and that's by sword.
Or by debt.
Or by debt. And we certainly see the paramilitary operations beating down people who are committing peaceful civil disobedience. We see that. We see mass incarceration. We see a war on drugs, which has failed but has filled prisons. And we could go on and on about the prison industrial complex, where municipalities are mandated to keep their prisons 85% full. They're mandated by law to keep their prisons full. So that's not a good thing.
So talking to your neighbors, your friends, your family is important, and keeping things followed up is not. And that's what we want to talk about on Lives in the Balance sheet, is that we are all connected.
And the issues that we are talking about, they're all connected. There's a common cause.
There's a common thread
for everything that we're talking about, and it all points back to a deteriorating system of capitalism, which has served a great purpose, but unfortunately now conditions are such that technologies have increased. The workforce has increased beyond the need for labor. So labor is no longer in demand. And the employers of labor are going overseas where there are fewer regulations, whether it be safety regulations, health regulations, labor regulations, employment regulations, blah, 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 blah. And this Trans-Pacific Partnership is not going to make things any better, since it circumvents.
But we can talk about that on a future show, to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I'm getting the hook.
The hook,
okay.
Yep, because people might not know what that is.
You're right. we're going to close our show. We're going to say thank you very, very much for listening to us.
Yes.
We're going to introduce a song here, which I should have queued up. Let's see here. Here we go. And it was written by our good friend Jim Clerico. You can get his music going to Sand Kicking Music on YouTube. It's a great song that talks about how we're all connected and how we should work together. So with that, Ben and I are going to say good night.
Because all we have is each other.
This is for the 99. Refugees of a grand design, victims of one and the same party line. We need to give chase to the space they occupy. Hey, we're doing swell. See how we work like hell. All for the minimum wage. Union man, where have you gone for to help us make a stand against the greedy cooperative? They took our train, ran it right into the ditch. Ain't it a bitch? Time to pull the switch. Hey, how'd you get to be so rich, Mr. Congressman? And who do you represent? Is it the 1% who pays the rent, attends every event with a political bent that's over the top? And who will arrange your next photo slot? And when they tell you trying to sell you somebody's vision of a dream. Oh, 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 somebody's vision of a dream. Somebody's vision of a dream. And you're like a nightmare. Makes us want a dream. It's a jungle out there. Give me my Medicare. Give it to me now, once and for all. If we got to get our backs from up against the wall. It's all been a show, and now you gotta go. You gotta listen when history tells you so. That's when the people lead, the leaders will follow. There's nothing to confuse, just walk a mile in our shoes. Shit, you know, the working man's blues. But you won't hear us counting on the fair and balanced news. Cause when they tell you in the spirit, it's a state of mind.